Let's talk about hair. If you're like me, you want hair products that are naturally beneficial and environmentally friendly. That's why I'm excited to share OMG Beauty products with you, because life's too short for a bad hair day, right? OMG Hair Care is your new go-to for clean, luxurious hair. Say goodbye to hair care confusion and hello to OMG Hair Care, founded by Natalie, a dedicated hair colorist who knows what your hair really needs. Her boutique brand is all about making clean beauty easy and fabulous. Here's a few reasons why you might love OMG Hair Care. They start with pure ingredients. The products are formulated in Australia with organic, naturally derived ingredients free from sulfates, parabens, and known irritants. You can create and customize. Their shampoos and conditioners are formulated with nourishing ingredients to cleanse, condition, and revitalize your hair. And it's safe for all. OMG Hair Care products are gentle enough for children and perfect for sensitive scalps. They're small but mighty. It's a boutique brand, but their mission is big, keeping hair care products clean, naturally beneficial, and most importantly, fabulous. With OMG Hair Care, every shampoo feels like a mini spa day, because clean beauty isn't just a trend, it's a lifestyle. Join the movement and wave goodbye to confusing choices and say hello to hair care that's honestly good for you. Would you like to experience a great hair day? Then head to omgbeautyproducts.com. For a limited time, you can get 30% off your first order. Just use the code SHOWCODE30. That's omgbeautyproducts.com and use code SHOWCODE30 for 30% off your first order.
This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. Well, hello, everyone.
Hello.
We're Murder in the Rain.
We are?
Ever heard of us? So we are somewhat back after an extended hiatus that started as maybe a month and a half and rolled into, I believe, four. But that's what happens when you get to take a vacation. And also, Josh and I were doing the math, and I was like, you know, in 5 years, 5.5 years, we never took a hiatus.
No,
so if you added up all those 2 week breaks, it would be our hiatus and the holidays and all of those things. So we wanted to check in with you guys. We've got an update on us as a show, which we'll get to in a little bit. We've got updates on our lives and we've got updates on a couple of cases. So I think we should start with our lives, maybe.
All right.
And things have changed. So when we were taking our break, Emily was getting her surgery.
That's right. I did a little nip tuck here and there in August. It went great. I'm very happy with it. I have two new friends.
We all have two new friends.
And titties have come a long way. They don't look anything like a Baywatch babe. You know,
I mean, had
like,
I wanted to, I might have been able to ask. I don't know.
Well, just they look great and they look very natural.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you.
You want to just soap them up, you know? In other titty news.
Well, I was going to say after that, you and I got hitched.
That's what I was talking about.
Oh, that's the big titty news.
That's right.
Yeah, Josh and I got hitched.
We sure did.
It changed everything.
We fight nonstop now. We both cheat on each other nonstop. And more kissing, though.
It was a beautiful wedding.
Oh, thank you. Emily did my hair and makeup, so when I post those pictures, that's all her.
It was great.
It was
just a canvas.
I was a little tipsy, but
it
turned out good.
Oh, made it perfect. That's because of heavy pour.
Yes. Our friend Yara doesn't know how to do a small pour.
She's like, here's some champagne. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it was a beautiful ceremony, wonderful reception. I wouldn't have changed anything except more time. Everyone was awesome. I think everyone had a great time.
The greatest wedding I've ever been to. And I think most people who were there or even worked there.
Yeah, I like to think
thought
so.
That. It was very special and I'm very proud of it.
I've spent more time at that lodge in one winter
than ever before.
And exciting, they've asked my band back for New Year's next year.
Yay.
Oh, that's right. Yay.
Yeah, Emily's cover band got to perform for New Year's.
And it was so
Timberline.
Fun. It was really, really fun.
I hope to have the funds to make it next year.
Yeah, it's, like, that'd it's a be two cool, day like, minimum. Ooh. It's a 2-day minimum. 7-course meal. The tickets are spendy, but it is so much fun.
Oh, I bet.
So I think I'm going to go for the whole weekend next year and maybe do some snowboarding or something.
Let's see what else. Oh, yeah. So I'm 2 weeks out from my boob surgery, which is opposite of Emily's. I had a breast reduction. I had a 7-pound booby baby.
Which, you know, if you don't have boobies, that may sound like nothing to you. But if you have boobies, you know what that means.
Yeah. So.
And they let us keep them.
Excuse you?
They let us keep them.
It's swaddled in the back room. Mm-hmm.
You're joking, right?
We're freeze drying it.
My Here's God. Your bag of fat.
Our new twins.
Freeze drying it. Just in case times get tough.
Yeah. I changed my mind, actually.
Booby jerky.
Yeah, we are. We can turn them into candles.
Oh my
Melt
God.
Them down to tallow.
Oh my God.
I saw.
You're going to turn into your own podcast.
Truly.
The soap maker.
Give me them leftovers. So recovery is going well. It's an adjustment. If anyone has any words of encouragement or questions.
Any
or
hot tits.
Hot tits or concerned tits. Or you're like, you know, I was thinking about doing that. It is the least regretted surgery, period. And I certainly don't regret it. It's just an adjustment to the new bod. But yeah, I'm looking forward to these babies dropping.
I know when mine dropped, it was pretty exciting.
Yeah, I bet. At that 6-week, it was like boing.
Badoof. like a toilet dunker.
Oh, yeah. What was it? Will it flush?
Oh, yeah.
Bathroom business.
Bathroom business.
What's that plunk?
It's back in business, baby. So, yeah. So that's kind of our personal stuff. And as for the show, we've been talking about some things. So we're actually going to get into the update. And then we'll get into the show update because you guys have been so patient with us. We've received your emails. We've seen your messages. Actually, I haven't seen all of them on Instagram because a huge part of me for this hiatus has been not being on social media because that's my least favorite part of this job. We hear you guys and we appreciate your checking in on us and everything's good. And yeah, there's going to be some tweaks and we'll let you know about that after these updates.
Tweaks, huh?
Hit it,
I got those nipples. All
maybe,
four of them.
Maybe
all
the
five
one on,
of them, actually.
The one on the left.
Wow, that's true.
Well, 7 and 7 if you count mine. And I do.
I was playing with my third nipple
seven
this morning.
Hell yeah.
In May of last year, I gave the update regarding my episode, Cosmic Coincidence. In that episode, I spoke about the murder of Barbara Tucker, a sophomore at Mount Hood Community College in Troutdale. Also, I know Alex Trebek was very refined and he always said a sophomore. I just can't bring myself to put that other O in there. I'm just not.
Most people ignore that extra O. I, however, pronounce it, and my friend Joy likes to make fun of me for it.
Of course. On January 15th, 1980, Barbara was planning on attending her evening business class, then going to her friend's house for ice cream afterwards. As she walked to class that night, Barbara encountered someone who unexpectedly struck her in the head with a blunt object. A violent attack ensued, but Barbara was able to, albeit very briefly, get away from her attacker. I always share this part of Barbara's story because I find it the most upsetting, and it serves as a good reminder that if you see something, say something, even if you aren't sure what that thing is. Crashing through the bushes, Barbara emerged onto Kane and 257th Drive with blood and splashes of mud on her face and clothing. Barbara began flagging down cars, frantically waving at passing traffic. Witnesses would later tell police that they did see the young woman, but being at a college campus, they just assumed that her actions of crawling into the street, to the point that cars had to swerve to avoid hitting her, with one even coming very close to doing so, were all just part of a college prank. None of those witnesses stopped to make sure that they were witnessing a joke. No one asked Barbara if her cries for help were real or not. Even when witnesses reported that they saw a young white male come out of that same wooded area, grab Barbara by her arms and drag her back into the woods, they still did not check on her, call for help, or do anything. Barbara had done everything she could to save herself, but no one did what they could to help. The next morning, a student walking to class discovered Barbara's partially dressed body in some bushes. Investigators noted drag marks in the dirt and 3 large pools of type O blood. Fast forward, and police were able to release a sketch of the suspect based on witness accounts. There wasn't much to be gleaned from it, a clean-shaven young white man wearing a ski cap and a jacket. Because she had been raped, there was DNA evidence that was saved, but it was of no use at the time, as technology to test it had not yet been developed. Through the years, the cold case unit continued to work on every tip they received and reviewed evidence throughout the years until this became the longest unsolved case in Gresham, Oregon's history. In June of 2021, 41 years after Barbara's murder, DNA from the scene was submitted to Parabon Nanolabs. That's when Gresham PD finally got a hit. It was a match to someone already on the judicial system's radar. His name was Robert Plimpton, an unemployed river guide. In 1997, Troutdale resident Robert Plimpton was arrested after a woman accused him of taking her to a secluded wooded area where he attempted to rape and sodomize her. She was able to get away and press charges against him. I'm going to go ahead and assume that he was not questioned in Barbara's murder, even though the circumstances were quite similar. That may have been due to the fact that at the time of Barbara's murder, Robert was only 16 years old, attending my alma mater, Reynolds High School. In June of...
Buccaneers.
Go Raiders.
Oh, that's what I always say.
Maybe we shouldn't be...
Raiders! Raiders! Raiders!
Maybe our mascot shouldn't be a creature of pillaging and rape. Just saying. In June of 2021, police stopped Robert's vehicle, and he was charged with Barbara's murder and pleaded not guilty. 3 years later, and at our last update, Robert did not take any kind of deal. He went to trial with a judge instead of a jury. There's obviously a lot more detail there, including how they caught him via bubblegum.
One of my favorites.
Stop chewing. If you have murdered, don't chew gum. And
don't throw away your napkins. Just take your garbage with
you. And also, don't murder.
Yeah, you should invest in handkerchiefs. Yeah. Handkerchiefs.
I love it. It's like you've gotten away this long. You think you're always going to get away. You'll slip up.
Yeah, it's the ego.
You're just going to enjoy some bubblicious or a big
bazooka.
Wad of big league chew.
Once his trial began, Robert's defense was pretty impenetrable. He didn't look like the witness descriptions, you know, because those are always 100% accurate. Judge Amy Baggio found that claim laughable and said as part of her decision, "To be clear, this court has zero doubt whatsoever that Robert Plimpton beat Barbara Tucker in her head and face until she died, and he was found guilty." Unfortunately, and in what is one of the worst legal rules, Robert was not convicted on sexual assault charges, even though that is how they acquired his DNA, because it could not be proven if any sexual assault occurred before or after she had been killed.
And I just think that's horrible. It's like you're still sexually assaulting someone's body.
She can't give consent. She's dead. And you killed her to be able to do that.
So ridiculous. You're just giving people more of a reason to kill someone.
Yeah.
When you said rules, mm-hmm. did you mean rulings or do you mean rules? Like, are you talking about a law or a ruling?
More like the rule, like basically because they decide, oh, the rule says we can't determine.
Okay.
Or we can't decipher if that was before or after, so we have to kind of throw it out.
Sick.
Yeah. So after being found guilty of first-degree murder, our update is that Robert Plimpton has been sentenced to 40 years.
Woo!
Now that he is 60 years old, that is pretty much a guaranteed life sentence, which is wonderful news. So at 16 years old, he brutally murdered Barbara Tucker, went on to own a river tour business, attempted to assault at least one other woman, and went on to spend 44 years living with his folks in Troutdale, never raising suspicion as to what kind of monster he actually was. I am very happy that his sentence is close to the same amount of years he got to have as a free man, because that's always my personal rule. If you're out for 40 years and you never got caught, you automatically get 40 years.
I also hope that he was looking over his shoulder those 40 years, even a
little bit. I would like to think so. And now we get to finally say goodbye to Robert Plimpton, RIP, except not rest in peace, rot in prison. Bye-bye, Robert.
In March of 2023, I had the privilege of sitting down with Carly Bodine to discuss her mother's case in our episode, The System Failed Her. In the pre-dawn hours of January 22nd, 2007, the body of Karen Bodine, a 37-year-old mother of three, was discovered by a passerby at the entrance of a gravel pit in Rochester, Washington. Karen's body was found nude and covered in bruising and cuts. She had ligature marks around her neck, and her body had been tossed aside amongst garbage and car parts. Just mere hours before the discovery, a police officer spoke to Karen and had the opportunity to make sure she got home safely to her family, but they didn't. So what happened to Karen Bodine? Well, for 18 years, her family has been searching for the answer to that question. Carly and I discussed what she knew about the night of her mother's murder and even the suspects considered in her case. It's one of those cases, as you listen along, you wonder, why is this not solved? We also spend a portion of our interview speaking to the newly appointed Sheriff Derek Sanders, who expressed his eagerness to begin solving the many unsolved murder cases from Thurston County. When I asked him what his major challenges were when it came to cases like Karen's, he said it boiled down to funding. We talk about this frequently on the show. Many police departments do not employ cold case detectives and rely on other staff offering a portion of their work week to cold cases or even their spare time. Sheriff Sanders was hoping that over his time with the department, he would improve their ability to dedicate attention to these types of cases. Sheriff Sanders started forming a working relationship with Carly and even attended Karen's annual gathering on the anniversary of her death. Last year marked his second year joining the gathering, where he was able to provide a bit of good news to Karen's friends and family. His update was regarding a recently passed public safety tax, which would allow the Thurston County Sheriff's Office to hire 27 deputies, as well as a two-person cold case and missing persons unit, which would launch in June of 2024. This January marked the third gathering Sheriff Sanders was able to attend. Unfortunately, there was no news to bring other than a promise to dedicate more time and effort to Karen's case and other cases like hers. So while they did get a little bit of funding, we're still not seeing any movement on the case. We also know during that episode, if you go back and listen, they were going to send some DNA evidence to get further testing. I haven't heard anything new on that, so I have to think that it didn't really bring anything new to the case, but they're still...
Or if they've even gotten to it.
Right.
Who knows how long that queue is.
Exactly. So we're still waiting for information. So if you have any information that would help solve this case, please contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477 or the Thurston County Sheriff's Office at 360-786-5500.
And I think that's a really important thing to bring up because, you know, if you hear defund the police or abolish or things like that, it's not even so much of like get rid of these people. But if you look at the funding and go, why is it you have X number of millions of dollars to have a militarized truck? When I think if you asked people in a community, like, what would be most important to you, it would be like, could we close some cold cases and get killers off the street?
And I can't remember the stats right now off the top of my head, but Thurston County has an obscenely high number of unsolved cases comparatively to other counties in Washington and Oregon.
Yes. Sheriff Sanders and I are not friends.
At least not on Instagram.
juicy tidbit. He's very attractive, quite young. I think the move to hire him was more of a media move to give them a face.
You hear that, pretty boy?
They have closed a few cases. They are trying. But yeah, I mean, he was kind of working at a major disadvantage with the funding. But yeah, I don't think Carly's too pleased with him, too. She rolled her eyes more times than I could count in that interview.
Yeah, it's just hard. It's like when you see, oh, here's our new fleet of vehicles. Here's our military grade weapons.
No,
and it's
we
like,
want brains.
Why do we need military grade weapons?
One good detective can do so much comparatively.
Yeah. Well, hopefully they get an answer on that DNA.
I hope so. And it's just one of those cases where it's like, we all know who did it.
Right.
Like,
right,
come
right on.
Quite attractive is quite a stretch.
Is it? It's been a while. It's
he
been
looks
a while.
Like a
Let
cop
me look.
With a goatee.
Okay, at the time, I thought I remembered him being attractive. Let me look.
Well,
he's not smiling, or maybe not looking directly.
I love
into
that
the camera.
You called me out on this. I gotta look it up now.
Well, I just.
She's saying comparatively.
I guess he's kind. There's one photo of him where he's slightly.
I think he's okay in the world of
law enforcement
hot. In the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, that's
true. I mean, he's all right.
He's all right. I give him 5 out of 10.
The eyebrows could use some attention.
And yeah, how's Shane Barton's case doing there, Sanders?
So many unsolved cases in that area. Okay, here, when he has sunglasses on, I think he looks real good. Okay, ooh, short sleeves.
If he's in a full ski mask, he's got, and sunglasses.
He's got tattooed arms, so yeah, you know how I feel about that.
You don't like it?
No, I love it.
We've covered so many cases through the years, and it does take an emotional toll to hold on to them, but some just dig their nails in, and you find yourself thinking of them often. One of those cases for myself is from the episode HOMICIDE. In it, I told the story of Dennis Day, the former Mickey Mouseketeer who went missing from his home in July of 2018. Okay, a quick recap before we get into the update. In the days before Dennis was last seen, he had admitted his partner, his husband, into a care facility. Dennis then spoke with a friend about needing help around his home in Phoenix, Oregon. That friend suggested Daniel Bruda. An arrangement was made, and Daniel became Dennis's handyman and eventual roommate in exchange for the work he was doing. But things quickly turned sour, and Dennis claimed that Daniel had been physically aggressive against him. When Daniel pushed Dennis down, that was it for Dennis, and he wanted him gone and a police report made. But when that happened, it was a Sunday night, and they would have to wait until the following day as the police station was closed. Phoenix is a very small town. No police report was ever made, and Dennis was never seen again. Anxiously awaiting for his husband to come visit on that Monday, Ernie, his husband, sat in his new home, but Dennis never showed. Ernie asked the employees of the home to contact the police. When they went to the couple's home for a welfare check, Daniel answered. When they asked about Dennis, Daniel claimed that he had gone out of town to visit people, but he wasn't sure who, where, or for how long. Ernie agreed that Dennis may have left town to visit family or friends, but he hadn't been specific about any plans. 10 days after that first welfare check, police returned to the home, but there were still no signs of Dennis. Because it had been so long without any contact, an APB was put out for Dennis's vehicle. This move wasn't necessary, though, as the day before, Dennis's car had actually been found, and it was in the possession of Lori DeClusen, who claimed to be borrowing the car from her friend Dennis. But her actual friend in this scenario was Daniel. Dennis was listed as officially missing, and a more focused investigation was launched. Daniel was questioned again, sticking to his story of Dennis, saying that he was leaving to see friends. While that all seemed like the only logical answer at that point, close friends found it hard to believe that their friend, who had basically become a hermit, hardly leaving his home, would have left and would be gone for more than a few days, if at all. Police reached out to any and all friends and family they could find. No one that the police contacted had heard from Dennis or had made any plans to see him. The car was searched, as was Dennis's home. His place was small and very crowded. There were reports that implied that Dennis and Ernie did have hoarding issues, or as my training has taught me, they were acquirers to a certain degree. This could have led to the house being more difficult for searches, but throughout this time, 3 searches were conducted, and they were hoping to find any sign as to where Dennis would have gone. During these searches, the police went through the couple's drawers, cabinets, and even their crawl space. Weeks of investigation and searches turned into months. A Facebook group was created to help with tips. Banners were created and posted. Thanks to his childhood work of being a Mouseketeer, news outlets across the state, country, and eventually the globe were asking, "Where is the missing Mouseketeer?" 5 months into the search, Phoenix Police, a very small department, was able to get help from 2 detectives, one from Oregon State Police and one from the Jackson County Sheriff's Department. Thanks to Dennis's fame and now notorious case, his family raised enough money to hire a private investigator, but nothing came from that. This next bit is pretty pertinent to the update. From as early as 3 weeks into the investigation, there had been reports from neighbors and calls to 911 saying that there was a foul odor coming from Dennis's house. One of the calls came from the Meals on Wheels volunteer who was delivering meals to the home. Officers did not go to the house after each of these calls, but they did go to the house to conduct several searches. They never reported any overwhelmingly concerning smell, although there were reports of urine and excrement, I believe, from pets that was throughout the house, which did cause an odor, so that might have masked any kind of decaying smell. Finally, in April of 2019, 10 months after Dennis was last seen, officers finally brought in a canine unit to the house to search. After 3 unsuccessful searches, they finally got a hit on something, and it was a lot more than a clue. The dog had signaled at something under a pile of laundry. Sadly, what the dog had discovered was Dennis's decomposing body, a body that, according to a Day family lawyer, had been stepped on and walked across while concealed beneath the clothes multiple times by police officers. Officers and detectives had stepped on his remains so much that they had actually caused skeletal fractures. It took a month for the remains to be confirmed as Dennis's, as DNA and dental records could not be used due to his body's condition. The investigation had changed from a missing person to homicide due to the body being hidden under those clothes. Back in July of 2018, Dennis had called the police before his disappearance. He reported to the police that his live-in handyman, Daniel Bruda, had, quote, behaved violently towards him. The responding officer's solution? That he, Dennis, would need to start the formal eviction process against Daniel.
You said they couldn't do dental record match?
Yeah.
Was that because of the skeletal damage or because he didn't have natural teeth?
It did not say, and I assumed a little mix of both, that perhaps he maybe had dentures and they were gone, or if the skull had been fractured, that it broke the teeth and it wouldn't have matched up. I'm not sure why they couldn't do dental. I was surprised by that as well. At the start of the searches and investigation, when Dennis was still considered missing, the police spoke with Daniel at the house on two different occasions. On the body cam footage, there are obvious injuries and wounds to Daniel's hands and arms that were consistent with an altercation, but they never asked about it. In June of 2019, Daniel, the woman found in Dennis's and Ernie's car, Lori DeClusen, and another woman, Wanda Garcia, were all arrested. Daniel was arrested and charged with manslaughter, abuse of a corpse, and identity theft. It was then the 36-year-old's extensive legal history came to light. He had a decade-long arrest and prison record, including serving time for sodomy, robbery, and assault. He also started using methamphetamines a year before Dennis's death. For more information, I went into great detail about their charges and the accounts of what happened in our update from last August. So go check that out if you need more information. After the arrest, Daniel Bruda was found unfit to stand trial due to a mental health condition. It was clear to the doctors who worked with him that Daniel was unaware of how serious his actions were or how serious the charges were. This was at the end of 2019. The woman found using Dennis's car and found being in possession of stolen items from the home was Lori Ann DeClusen. She pled not guilty to charges of unauthorized use of a motor vehicle and first-degree theft. Wanda Diane Garcia, the other woman who had been in Dennis's car, pled guilty to vehicle theft and was sentenced to a year and a half on probation. Lori skipped court and a warrant was put out. She was eventually arrested because she walked away from a correctional facility and stole another car. She was later arrested in a Buffalo Wild Wings parking lot. Lori and another man, which I believe may have been her husband, Curtis DeClusen, were both called in to be witnesses for the state of Oregon against Daniel, especially since Lori had spent time in Dennis's home, where Daniel told her to stay out of a specific room, and she also reported smelling a pungent and off-putting smell. Daniel was eventually found fit for trial. At the first hearing for the 12 charges against him, he pleaded not guilty. In July of 2024, Daniel entered a modified guilty plea of no contest against the charges of criminally negligent homicide and abuse of a corpse. While he was out of custody, he was found guilty of burglary, earning a separate 2-year sentence. For the negligent homicide of Dennis Day and abuse of his corpse, Daniel Bruda was sentenced to 4 whole years. Because of the police's inability to find Dennis's body for so long and because of the damage they caused to his corpse, his family sued the Phoenix, Oregon Police Department for $2 million. The 11-page lawsuit accuses the Phoenix police of botching the entire investigation. Dennis's family alleged that the department conducted a negligent investigation, including torturous interference with a corpse and intentional infliction of emotional distress. Part of that suit is in regard to the smell that had been reported. Quote, for a period of 9 months from Mr. Day's disappearance, defendants failed to adequately search the Pine Street premises despite substantial evidence that a dead body was inside, including multiple complaints from neighbors and the Meals on Wheels delivery person that had a smell of death emanating from inside the house. Another allegation was that the family didn't learn of Dennis's disappearance from the assigned investigator, but from a news story. Additional and valid issues the family had with the investigation were that the family didn't know the cause of death because of the body's condition, due in part to the skeletal fractures from their searches and the delay in finding the body. This, of course, led to Daniel being charged with only manslaughter and not murder. The family was told a search dog had inspected the home on January 30th, 2019, but that did not take place. The family was also told the assisting detectives from other jurisdictions would take place in February, but the transfer did not occur until March. And as soon as it took effect, Oregon State Police brought in the dog, which found the body. So basically, if the Phoenix police had taken it more seriously immediately, especially regarding the smell, and brought in someone else who could have brought in the search dog, they would have found him immediately, which could have shown them maybe he was bludgeoned, maybe he was strangled, maybe he was beaten, which could have led to murder charges for Daniel instead of the manslaughter. Because Daniel can just say, oh, I didn't know he was even in there. Or, oh, he fell down and I was scared, so I covered him. So basically, their botched investigation let him, in my opinion, get away with murder. During the searches and investigation, Daniel was questioned, seen with unexplained wounds on his arms and hands, and told to leave the home as he was trespassing. But he was not forced to leave. Perhaps most shocking, Daniel was found to be in possession of Dennis's ATM card, which the police took on August 8th, 2019. But the police did not include him as a suspect at that time. So you've got a missing dude, you find someone in his house who he has already complained about him being violent with, and then you find him being in possession of the missing person's ATM card, and they're like, nah, he's not a suspect. That's fine. A federal lawsuit was filed, as was one against Jackson County. On the third day of the county suit trial, Judge Timothy Barnack granted the request made by the defense lawyer for the case to be dismissed. The family, aka plaintiff side, presented nearly a dozen witnesses, shared their case, and even presented a body cam video from only 10 days after Dennis was missing. And while completing one of their searches in the room that his body would later be found in, one officer can be heard saying, "It smells of a dead body." And that was 10 days, not 10 months, 10 days. The defense, aka the county and the officers, didn't even present their part of their case before the dismissal. The judge had told the defense lawyer before the case was over, quote, "I don't think you have a case." So before they even get to it, the judge is like, no, I'm going to rule in the cop's favor. After the dismissal, the same defense lawyer spoke with the jury member who said that they felt that the officers and the city were negligent and they didn't think it was even possible that they could have done those searches and not found his body sooner. As part of the appeal to the decision, the defense will bring up that it was found that an officer had actually cracked Dennis's skull by stepping on it just a few days after the first complaint of Dennis's disappearance. So I'm sorry these updates never seem to be good news, since I was hoping this trial would go through and the family would at least be given that. That obviously doesn't give you Dennis, but it validates them. They're sitting there going, wait, 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 you smelled this. You had complaints of smell. He had told you he'd been violent. You found him with these wounds. You found the ATM card and you still didn't find him for all this time. And you caused us this distress. And so to have that go to trial and have them win would be like, yes, we're sorry. We messed up and you're right. And instead, the judge is like, you're not winning this, and dismissed it. So that really sucks. I'm hopeful that their appeal will be granted. And maybe a full trial will be heard by a jury and they'll get to deliberate and come to a good conclusion. And by sharing these stories, I at least hope that more people will hear about it. And maybe you live in Jackson County or you feel like emailing people there to go, hey, let's put some pressure on here and do the right thing for Dennis Day and his family. Okay, now I've got an update out of Seattle. You may remember 2 years ago, I told the story of Janavi Kandula. On the night of January 23rd, 2023, 23-year-old Janavi was starting to utilize the crosswalk in South Lake Union. At that same time, a police cruiser, sporadically using his lights and a chirp of the siren, barreled down the street at 74 miles an hour. The speed limit for that street is 25 miles an hour. I don't know, I'm not familiar with that area, but there has been a video that's been released, and it's pretty unfathomable that that officer was going that speed. It appears to be a business area with large buildings, maybe a busy area, a fairly tight street. In the video, in the left lane, or perhaps two lanes, I can't quite tell, there's a bus, maybe some parked cars, and it's hard to see because of the speed the vehicle's traveling and that it's at night. There's a middle lane with what appears to be a pedestrian island surrounded by delineators, and there is a lot of reflective signage marking the crosswalk and pedestrians. You can hear a few clicks of the chirp from inside the car. It is dark out, so visibility was far from ideal. Now, the reason Officer Kevin Dave, who was behind the wheel, was driving so fast was because he was actually responding to a call of someone overdosing. So yes, it was an emergency, but his actions created another one. On the right side of the street, there appears to be concrete blocks for perhaps parking or maybe a bike road, pedestrians, or even restaurants. All of these elements, the blocks, the buildings, lighting, tight roads, made this moment nearly unavoidable. As Genovese started to step into the street, the lightning bolt of the cruiser catches her eye. Only about a third across the lane, she appears to panic, and in that millisecond, she decided to pick up speed to get out of the way, which is a decision I think most people would make, because your brain says it makes more sense to keep going where you're going than to take the time to turn around, get your bearings, and try to make a run for it that way. Unfortunately, as she moved, that put her right in front of the speeding cruiser. This story made headlines later in the year when the body cam video of Officer Arderer, who was speaking with the president of the SPD Guild, and he was caught laughing about the situation, going so far as to joke that the department should just write the family the standard $11,000 check, saying, quote, "She was 26 anyway. She had limited value." Since Janavi's death, there have been several investigations. Witnesses corroborated video proving that, against procedure, Officer Dave did not have his lights or siren on consistently. He also didn't even attempt to brake when he saw her in the crosswalk. Another body cam video shows Kevin Dave speaking with other cops afterwards, saying, "She was in the crosswalk. She saw me. She started running through the crosswalk. I slammed on my brakes." He did not do that. "Instead of staying back where she should. So basically, well, she ran in front of me." Later, Dave is crying and distraught, telling one officer he's not okay and muttering, "I fucked up," to another officer as they're all trying to comfort him. Oh, and side note, as for that overdose call that he was responding to, it was actually some dude who had just done too much coke and he was starting to freak out. He was found responsive, just walking around and talking outside of his apartment while waiting for medical personnel. So I don't know where that ball got dropped either, if it was miscommunicated as being more of an emergency or if he just decided to treat it as a higher one. But I'm curious of that person, if he even knows that this is all part of, that he's part of that story, you know, of her life. In June of 2024, Officer Daniel Arderer, the one laughing about the situation and Genovese value, was terminated. And that man, who would go on to claim how his comments were totally unforgivable, they would haunt his soul. And he would also fight back by saying it was really not a joke about her value, but it was a joke against the city's lawyers and how much of a pain in the ass they are about these kind of settlements, which did not fly. So with a little bit of dignity and shame, he walked away from the job that he was clearly not qualified for. Just kidding. He has since filed a $20 million lawsuit against the city of Seattle because he felt his firing wasn't due to him being a piece of shit who betrayed the trust of the city. No, it was because of his connection to the union. Let's talk about limited value, huh? You think your firing, not even your life, but your firing is worth $20 million that you want to take from your city and the children of your city, but okay. On January 7th of this year, Officer Kevin Dave was terminated from the SPD. He was the one actually behind the wheel, driving, responding to that emergency. There were four main reasons for his termination. He did not follow department policy. This was regarding the use of the lights and siren and speed. He did not modify his response while speeding to an emergency. Again, he should have gone slower in the slower zones and used his lights properly. He didn't safely operate his police vehicle, and he did not have his emergency lights on. Fun fact, Officer Kevin Dave was actually involved in another car crash in September of 2021. Again, he was responding to a call but had failed to use his siren. An investigation found that he, quote, failed to clear an intersection and caused a preventable collision. They also found that he failed to drive with due regard for the safety of all persons, even if he did not possess the aggravated kind of negligence or carelessness required for criminal charges. So even though he was in a nearly identical situation, driving too fast in a dense area without a siren, he was not criminally charged. But it does appear that he admitted to second-degree negligent driving and kept his license after paying a $5,000 penalty and completing an 8-hour driving course. So for now, we'll have to just be relieved that Kevin Dave is not behind the wheel of his police cruiser. He has, of course, appealed his termination, but we'll keep you posted on that lawsuit and appeal. And hopefully Arterer does not get $20 million because he was bad at his job. And Kevin Dave does not get his job back because he's bad at his job. Just put the lights on, guys. They're in there. That's what they're for. So those are our case, some of the case updates. We have several more in the backlog waiting to be shared. So for now, we want to get to the update on the show.
Yep.
Which I'm not even sure what it is, except
to
say.
We're not sure exactly, but we want to be transparent with
yes,
you.
Yes, we do want to be fully transparent. So here's the deal. We have worked very hard on this show for over 5 years. April will be, well, January now is
yeah,
6 years,
6 years
from when we started piecing it together.
That's when we first recorded. Was
that's
in January.
Right.
Yeah,
thank
that's
you.
True. We talked about it.
January 19th, remember?
That November is when we started talking, I believe.
And it's been amazing. And we've met so many people. I like to think we've helped some people by getting stories out and offering resources and things of that nature.
A platform,
yeah. And I think for all of us, we kind of checked in with each other and we realized how much of a weight was lifted during this break. Not just in the work aspect of writing and researching and editing
and darkness,
you know,
of what we
so yes,
talk
the
about.
Weight of what it is. And we're privileged enough to be in a space to step back from it. And we've all realized that that has been really healthy feeling. Especially with the state of the world right now, which is uncertain. So we don't have an answer. We wanted to present this update. We do have a couple episodes that are in the can.
Ready to go.
So we're kind of playing it by ear. We don't want to say goodbye. We're not ready for that. We don't want to leave you guys hanging either because you deserve better than that.
Well, we've talked about monthly episodes for the time being.
Yeah. Like basically, so here's, I think this is where we're landing, which is we will release those episodes. I think we'll go to monthly just to kind of keep the pulse of the show alive and maybe reconvene in the summer. We've got some, mm-hmm. there are some events coming up. There's kind of a secret thing we're working on with other shows that we still want to be a part of and we still want to be in this community and do what we can. But I think we all trust our gut. And when it comes time to putting the key in the ignition, we all said, ugh.
Yeah.
And when that happens, you really have to listen to yourself because that's going to affect the joy of what you do. That's going to affect the output of what you create. So that's kind of where we're at. So basically, we ask that you are patient with us. And for the next 6 months, we're just kind of going to sporadically release stuff. We're going to play around on Patreon and maybe do more pop culture crime, or here are some
different
docs.
Types of content.
Yeah, like here are some docs we're watching, or here's a good horror movie we've seen.
Also, we do really want to be transparent throughout
yeah.
us making these decisions. So
yeah.
we will touch base with you again.
Yeah, which is why we don't have a solid answer.
Right.
We're saying, you know what? We're going to revisit this in the summer. So for the next 6 months, there'll probably only be 6 episodes. We might get a bug up our ass and be like, hey, actually, I wrote something and want to record this episode
yeah.
to put out.
But at minimum,
yes.
6 episodes.
Yes. And there might be 2-parters in there. There might be whatever. But and we know you guys get it. Right now, trying to promote something feels impossible. Is Instagram dead? Everyone's moving away from Meta for good reason. TikTok is coming and going. It's a lot of chaos. And so I personally hate to remove something that is grounding for anyone. You know, people have said, oh, when are you coming back? I need to be able to sleep to your stories and that kind of thing. So we don't want to take that away. And we are still here and you can still email us and we'll still check in. We're not disappearing.
Yeah, we're not disappearing. We're here.
We're just saying we need to recognize what this does for our mental health and our physical health and our free time. Emily is like in this new phase of life. She's like working out like crazy and is pursuing new passions, which is amazing. And this would be a hindrance. And
well,
Josh and I are pursuing
stuff. I think it's still, you know, we still work. This isn't just what we do, right?
Like right.
I work full time and I have a big job these days. So
right. And you have a teenage. I mean, Josh and I are very lucky that this really is our job. We have other projects we work on. but this has kind of been our main focus, but it is an overwhelming darkness at times. And you do work more than full time, and you have a teenage daughter, and you have a social life. So I think for all of us, it's just like, we love it. We love it too much. And there's too much still here to do to say,
yeah,
we're over it. We're done. The pulse is going to be a lot slower.
Who knows how we'll feel 6 months from now.
But it'll have a pulse.
This morning was still so enjoyable to record with you guys. It's still so fulfilling.
Yeah.
But all the lead up to it has become so difficult.
Yeah. And I don't think a lot of people understand the number of hours go into researching super dark content, writing it, editing
police
it.
Police reports, crime scene
photos. It never
photos.
Leaves the brain.
Right. Yeah. Like, these cases live with us, these families who we work with unsolved cases, the interviews we do, like, we think about them all the time. Yeah. And it does, after a while, wear on you if you don't have like lighter aspects in life to invest in.
Right. And like I said, we're very privileged. This isn't a personal case where it's we're fighting and, you know, like Ariel and the United Justice Group, that is their life. Mm-hmm. And they don't get to walk away from it.
Right.
But then maybe we have more space to be able to help them on things outside of that instead of, oh, no, we're recording, or, oh, no, we'll still be around sharing stories, and we'll just keep you posted, and we appreciate your patience. We understand if you are annoyed and you move on. That makes sense. But we also appreciate that you guys are so loving and kind and patient. And
we're not trying to toot our own horn by saying it takes a lot of work and is difficult. It just really does. And I don't know how much time other shows spend with research and writing.
A lot of them have
people.
And they have staff. It's been all just
the three of us
from the beginning.
Always.
And we have no one else inputting anything.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity to shake things up a little bit and see what works or what gets us excited again.
Yeah. We're certainly not giving up on everything, and we're not walking away. We're just reevaluating. So we appreciate you guys. We love you guys. We're not going anywhere, and we'll keep you posted. And in a couple weeks, I've got a double episode. We'll be releasing that. And then a couple weeks after that, we'll have Josh's episode. So there you go.
And it's a good one.
It is. Well, talk to y'all later.
What should I put at the end? What music should I put? Like Auld Lang Syne or like Danny Boy or something?
No, that's too sad.
Yeah, just do regular.
How about Nearer My God to Thee? What they were playing when the Titanic was sinking.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
I'll do that. Thank you, gentlemen. It's been an honor to play with you.
That's so funny.
But we're not sinking. We're just getting
we're just
in
going
a lifeboat.
To heaven.
Yeah, but we're
going
funny, and people expect that from
us. Yeah.
That's true, we are.
No,
funny.
But take it away, James Horner. Oh no, I mean, take it away. Who did that?
Which one is it? Closer, My God, to Thee?
Nearer, My God, to Thee.
Nearer, My God, to Thee.
I think that's what it is. Doesn't matter.
All right.
Nope.
I need some food.
I'm like Andy Bernard when he goes running and my nipples.
Oh, God.
I need huge bandages for my nipples.
He has erect, sensitive nipples.
And it's cold out.
I understand fully.
Ouch. I feel like I could snap them off. Hariola.
Oh.
All right.
Hariola.
Oh. The detective?
The snowman. He looks like a soft potato.
He's a soft potato. Although, one from the Oregon State Police and one from Jackson. But yes, I was surprised at that by Walt.
I was surprised by
Walt. All right. Because it's very easy for him
I'm
to
so
say.
Sorry.
She won at Sudoku.
Which the police took on August 8th. ATM card. Which the police took on August 8th. Am I saying that right? It sounds nuss. Nuss. That sounds nuts, guys.
This sounds nuts. You guys are nuts.
Caused a preventable fucking face.
What? What's wrong with your face?
That just came out.
Can't be treating a Mouseketeer like that.
That's right.
They put their lives on the line every day to Katir mice. Yes. Go ahead.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderintherain. And suck my balls.